The Lifeboat Hour with Michael Rupert, Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Nightclub at the end of the world. Hi, everybody. It's Mike Rupert on January 29, 2012. Welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour. Well, it's been an amazing week, and so many things have happened. But what has become clear this week is that the United States is in retreat on all fronts with regards to its efforts to exert its will around the world. The Iranian war, the major battle of which was not engaged, is off the table now. Regime change in Syria is off the table now. The U.S. gave an oil embargo, and nobody came. And Iran has successfully, really just dealing with reality, turned the tables and is in full command of the world oil supply now, threatening to shut off supplies to Europe, which is, of course, on its deathbed. So, these are just amazing times, but it's been a week in which I've seen a lot of optimism. I will add, however, that violence around the world is really erupting in a great many cities, and a great many cities, large cities around the world, are also experiencing major power outages, blackouts, and this is not a quiet winter. And if the winter is this way, we can pretty much imagine that come springtime, it's going to be very, very sporty. So I want to get into our show tonight and our guest, and the theme for our show tonight is System D, and we're going to talk a lot about that tonight, and I have been incredibly touched by a book that I'm reading, but I want to set this up right, because there is so much about this thing called System D that is really outside of the box that most of us have thought in. I mean, I had a spiritual teacher once say to me, it's not what I don't know that kills me, it's what I don't know that I don't know that kills me. And there is so much that we don't know, and we're going to learn about that tonight. But I did a segment with Max Kaiser this week, and it was a lot of fun. It's always good to be with Max. And they're doing great work over there, by the way. And we talked about SOPA and PIPA, which were defeated this week. Do not ignore ACTA, though. Do not assume that we won two and ACTA is a European thing. No, there's so much vagary and skullduggery out there. So whatever everybody did to stop SOPA and PIPA, do it to ACTA, too. But I was talking to Max Kaiser, and the subject of piracy came up with respect, of course, I did this movie Collapse. And it took me through an interesting thought process. The movie was made. I got no pay for it up front. I had 15 points on back end. And, that's net profits. And the movie came out, and it was pirated more than 2 million times in the first 3 months that it was out. And I was starving. I was rolling quarters. I was selling personal possessions because I had put a lot of time and money into the movie. I should add parenthetically now that just about a month ago, I did receive my first check 2.5 years later for about $3,000. So I am I am a rare Hollywood breed. I am somebody who has a movie that actually made money. So that was a sidebar. But as I thought about the piracy and all that, which represents mega upload, but as it's sold, I missed something else, because what I have now, of course, is that it's the piracy that's the reason why CollapseNet is now in 68 countries around the world, and why we're being read by some very influential people. During this last week at CollapseNet, we caught a visitor at the White House, and we even captured a screenshot. Of course, we know that they're reading us in governments, capitals around the world. We had visitors this week. I'll just read a couple of the great places where our members are coming from: Kazakhstan, Dubai, Reykjavik, Iceland, Moscow. Tons of you guys from down under. I look at the map on the site, and we always see Australia and New Zealand lit up like Christmas trees, but we see them in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and Mumbai, India, in Joensuu, Finland. And for all you old CIA hands, we have regulars who come from Chiang Mai in Thailand. Ba-dum-bum-bum. New Plymouth, Queenstown, Hobart, Australia, Tel Aviv, Hammerfest, Norway. It's great. CollapseNet is giving you all what you need and what you want, and we're doing really good at it. We've come out of this period where we were being attacked, cyber attacked, and you can see the website is looking better now that we can work with it again, and we're delivering for you. So CollapseNet, $100 a year, 27 cents a day. I'm not no longer apologizing for how much that may be to some people, because I'm telling you it's cheap. Because a lot of people around the world that now are realizing that we're giving you something that you can't get anyplace else. All right, so enough with that. But that was a lesson with System D about the movie. And it was the piracy that allowed CollapseNet to become so successful. CollapseNet.com. And so that's a System D thing to do. And I'm going to throw one other thing out before I introduce Robert Neuwirth. I did something that I think was System D today. He'll tell me. I went out, you know, we have this 2.5 acres, a wonderful 2.5 acres, and I planted opium poppy seeds. They're just poppy seeds, opium poppies, and it's perfectly legal. I'm not going to score the bulbs on them, but what I'm going to do is over successive plantings and successive years, I get to cull and only keep the seeds from the largest plant so that over time, the poppies that grow from my seed stock will be larger and larger, and, you know, God forbid when the need arises and the medical establishment is not there and my neighbors are hurt, I'll have something to ease their pain with. So Robert Neuwirth, he's the author of Shadow Cities, A Billion Squatters, A New Urban World. He has worked as a business reporter and an investigative reporter and has covered cops, courts, and political campaigns. His articles have appeared in a variety of publications, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Scientific American. I mean, you name it, he's there. He also taught in the college program at Rikers Island, New York City's jail, and at Columbia University School of Journalism. That's a resume, dude. And he's been supported by the Fund for Investigative Journalism, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Nation Institute. He lives in Brooklyn. His new book is called Stealth of Nations, put out by, I believe, Random House, Pantheon. It's rocking the world. I heard him on an interview recently. So, Robert, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour.
Well, thank you for having me.
Can you say a couple of words? I want to make sure I have a good sound connection for you.
Okay. It's good to be here, and I really appreciate you having me on the show.
Good, good. Okay. This book, I have your book marked up like a racing form from Hialeah. You know, it's like, and I've only had it a week. So I had like 25 quotes. But this is where I want to start with us. And this is a quote from Stealth of Nations. System D questions the value of efficiency. Why is centralized planning, a highly organized and controlled shopping mall, for instance, better than a form of trade that employs more people, even as it may divide the pie into smaller slices, a seemingly disorganized and chaotic street market? Why is a more sober form of business better than a more cacophonous? Why are locked-in prices better than the fevered negotiation that goes on at a garage sale? Why is the standardization of design better than the overflowing bins and crowded alleys of the swap meet? In System D, employment has more value than efficiency, and the logic of small dealers trumps the rationality of the big retailer. In fact, there is a spontaneous sort of efficiency in the inefficiency of System D, something development economist Peter Bauer outlined after one of his trips to Africa. Quote, a colorful illustration is provided by the extensive business in used containers, Bauer wrote. Petty traders purchase, collect, store, clean, repair, and resell containers such as tins, boxes, bottles, and sacks. They thereby extend the effective life and use of these products. This is all outside the box. Let me just start by asking you this. How far outside the box, how do we define the box, is System D, and how powerful, how influential is System D in the world right now?
Well, look, the box is simply the what government recognizes as the economy. Mm-hmm. So outside the box is just outside of that. So the merchants in System D are not revolutionaries. The people who are recycling the containers and cartons that Peter Bauer wrote about are not necessarily revolutionaries, but what they're doing is without the approval of the government, and so in to that extent, they're outside of the box. In terms of, you know, how significant is it in the world, it's huge. In the developing world, it is the growth economy. It's the most important part of the economy. It's where half the workers of the world, more than half the workers of the world, are employed, and the total value of this sort of global quasi-underground is $10 trillion a year, which means that if it was united in a single country, it would be the second largest economy on Earth, rivaling the United States.
Okay, to what extent is System D free from the grasp, the tentacles, the vices, the reach of the Federal Reserve, Bank of International Settlements, IMF, World Bank? How vulnerable is it to their depredations?
Well, I mean, the issue here is that System D is sort of sneaking around through the crevices in the formal economy. And so it's on the surface, as what people do, it's completely immune from these mega institutions.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, because of the way global trade works and you need a currency, it's vulnerable to the fluctuations in global currency exchange. So exchange rates are a very important part of System D.
Now, when you were researching the book, you reported from Brazil, Paraguay, Lagos, Nigeria, China. Where else did you go?
Well, those were the four major places. I also did some reporting from the United States as well, because there is a System D in the United States. It's just we don't think about it too much, and we tend to think of it as a criminal underground. But in reality, although it's a very small percentage of our gross domestic product, given the size of the United States economy, the U.S. actually has the largest System D or underground economy in the world, worth $1 trillion.
One thing that really amazed me as I was reading your book, I'm into permaculture. I'm on 2.5 acres. Our movement's all about sustainability and detaching as much as we can from a collapsing paradigm. But I was blown away because we have issues about raw milk, raw food, organic food, and insane measures by the FDA. And I was shocked to read the story of all of the people who make food for, like, in Manhattan, who don't have licenses, don't have kitchens, and yet they're out there, it's out there being consumed. And in some cases, you think it's even healthier than the stuff that comes from the old way.
Well, certainly, because they're working in little batches, and they can't have things go bad. So to that extent, they're not holding on to food as long as the grocery store might be willing to hold on to it. And they don't have the storage facilities and the refrigerated storage, so the food is actually fresher. And this goes back many, many years. Push carts got maligned, but they were actually fresher during the old days in the Lower East Side 100 years ago. They were fresher than what was being sold in the stores.
And there's a lot of that going on now because, I lived for a short while in Brooklyn on Skirmerhorn, just south of the courthouse.
Sure.
In 2007. And I would go into any one of 100 places, a bodega, restaurant, whatever, deli, and there'd be these little wrapped cakes. And I always assumed, I was thinking in terms of the paradigm that, well, gee, this must have come from
Progressive Radio Network.
Factory kitchen. What happened there? That's kind of encouraging to see. Now, this is happening all over the world. I guess one of the other things that intrigued me about the book was I'm a great believer that place determines what happens. In other words, you really have to connect to the place where you are. And there's major differences, I guess, between the way System D would evolve in, say, in Lagos or Paraguay. How does setting influence it?
Oh, well, hugely. This is a culturally appropriate phenomenon, and it's different in different places. The similarity is simply that the people are evading the attention of government.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the similarity. But in reality, what's going on in Paraguay is mostly smuggling. What's going on in Nigeria is mostly tax avoidance and licensing avoidance. In both cases, they're existing without the approval of the government, but they're doing it in a different way.
In a speech I gave in New York, I guess the last time I was there, probably about July of 10, I came up with a line. I said, referring to what I would now look at as Occupy, and I'm stepping back now into a sociological, anthropological place. I said, we will be like grass growing up through the sidewalk, which very much reminds me like System D. And I said, we will live in the space between the ones and zeros of Cartesian tyranny, which is what System D is all about. And I've encountered a mindset among those of us who are aware of collapse, who are very active in the relocalization lifeboat movement. People, a paradigm is what you think about before you think about it. You know, the trap. And the assumption has always been, as the U.S. economy failed, that somehow these people just disappeared or all these unemployed didn't. But clearly in the U.S., how are all the people, who have survived the last 2 or 3 years being homeless, how are they making it now?
Well, that's the difficult thing. I mean, there's not a direct connection necessarily between homelessness and System D. And how they're making it is haphazardly. You know, some are getting jobs. Some are existing by begging. Some are existing because they found these little niche businesses that they can do selling things on the street and being part of System D. But, you know, survival in this kind of economy is a very difficult thing. And so you have to use your wits and you have to, you have to pursue any avenue that you possibly can.
I can't help but feel, I had a guest on the show, Charles Eisenstein, who wrote a magnificent book called Sacred Economics, which is where I see mankind will have to go when we leave infinite growth. And I feel like his book and your book are a bookend in helping us to look for a map in what we see as a transition from an obviously dying industrial infinite growth paradigm and whatever is going to come next. From an academic standpoint, the people on my side, until I read your book, we just all kind of said, well, okay, if we end the ancien regime of what we see running the world now, how will corporations or a food processing plant factor their receivables to get, you know, how do you get the goods and services, the food delivered? And your book gives me an incredible amount of optimism that we'll find a way to do that if we have to.
Well, absolutely. Look, the market continues, even though the so-called free market breaks down and disappears. Because the free market, as we all know, isn't really free and it's in favor of the corporations and all the things that you believe in collapse net. But it's just, I'm sorry, I lost my place for a second. I've got this echo in my phone.
And you're sounding a little weak on the board. It may be the Skype connection. I'll have the board operator signal me if he can hear you okay, but you're a little spotty at times.
You know, what I was saying is the economic system is broken, and what we have to do is create a new economic system more on cooperation. And that's what System D does. The potential in System D is that people organize themselves, and that's how distribution work will evolve.
Okay, I just got a message from the board that it is the Skype connection that's existing right now that's a little spotty. He says it's breaking up badly now. Here's what I'm going
to
do.
Call in again?
I'm sorry?
Do you want me to call again?
Yeah, what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to skip the station break tonight. PRN is a kind of System D. I get to break the rules every now and again, and Progressive Radio Network's very cool to let me skip the station break and the commercials at the bottom of the hour. We're going to do that at PRN FM. What we're going to do is, Robert, we're going to take a break. We are going to play a song from New White Trash, which I feel is kind of appropriate. It's called Say a Prayer for the New White Trash. That'll give you time to hang up and reconnect with the board. Thanks.
Great.
We'll be right back, guys. Yeah.
Your autocracy I use as target practice. You're so white trash. Top down and you're cruising for a reason. All the signs on the web that we use as target practice. You're so white trash. We're the people of the revolution. We're the people of the evolution. Say hello to me. Don't be white trash. We're the people of the revolution. We're the people of the evolution. Say hello to me. Don't be white trash.
Say hello to me. Say hello to me. Say hello to me.
For the new white trash. We hide our thumbs together. Got a head full of nasty weather. We're twine, bill and cash. Say hello to the new white trash. Good cars, smoking much, you don't care. Get holes in your three-day underwear. Sharp and ready in your tracks. Say hello to the new white trash.
Say clap on the new. Say clap on the new.
It doesn't all have to be that way, but we are the children of the evolution, and that's what's happening all over the world. We have Robert Neuwirth back with us. Robert, the board has asked if you could check and make sure that any background noise that appeared to be causing some of the breakup, if you have any there. Anyway, that was Say a Prayer for the New White Trash. You can find that. That was a band I was in, newwhitetrash.com. Check it out. We're back here. If you have questions tonight for Robert Neuwirth, you can call in to 1-888-874-4888, or you can email me directly at lifeboathour@collapsenet.com, lifeboathour@collapsenet.com. We're with Robert Neuwirth, author of the new book, Stealth of Nations. I heard this guy on a radio interview, I guess, with NPR, and flawless pronunciation. How many languages do you speak, Robert?
Well, I'm not fluent in any of them anymore, but you know, I can hack my way through a couple of languages, and I was lucky to have some really great people helping me in China and Nigeria to, you know, get me through the many tribal languages and the Mandarin and Cantonese. But you know, I do okay.
Yeah, you do. I give you a high five. I spent 4 months in Venezuela in 2006. In Caracas, and they have a huge, I forget the name of it, it was somewhere in between Altamira and El Paraíso in huge outdoor, everything in the world was there, and you were right, I saw movies that had only been out for 3 days, they were pirated, they were terrible quality, But it was a safe place to go, and it was a very functional place to go. Would more people go there? Do you to these markets if they knew really how effective they were?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the you know, big businesses are very involved in giving these markets a black eye, because they don't want to see them gain more customers, and so they would definitely attract more people, or there would be other markets that would spring up to get the overflow.
Mm-hmm.
So either way, there's tremendous growth potential here.
I noticed in Lagos, you talked a lot about how they grind up the plastic into, I guess, little beads, little balls of plastic. And that's because there's so much plastic there. And this seems to me like a business arising from trash and refuse. Does System D really take advantage of what's there in the environment in ways that other systems might not?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the key question is there money to be made from recycling? And when there is, I mean, people recycle plastic bags, people recycle the soles of shoes, people recycle all sorts of things that we don't think about. It's all a question of the kind of money you have and the kind of money you can make. So I do think that there's an efficiency in that, and that's not to praise the continual use of plastics in everything that we own these days. It's just to say that if we're going to use it, we need to be recycling it, and we're recycling it appropriately. And the folks in Lagos are much better at that than I am here in Brooklyn.
It was when I was listening to and reading some of your stuff about Lagos that I had a major epiphany with regards to oil supplies and how they're affecting the collapse of industrial civilization. We had run a story on CollapseNet about, I guess, 3-4 months ago now, saying that the Taj Mahal in India, the power blackouts were so regular that they had 60,000 diesel generators on standby, which kick in. Yeah. Of course, they pollute the sky. Japan is now getting a great deal of its lost electricity from diesel generators, especially at Fukushima. And the consumption of diesel fuel in Lagos must be astronomical. What, 9 million people in the city, and they're all running on diesel generators?
Yeah, basically.
Wow.
You know, I don't have a figure right in front of me of what the consumption of diesel is over the course of a year, but the electrical grid very seldom provides electricity. And I mean, I remember one day when I woke up in the morning and the electricity came on for 20 seconds. And we all ran to plug in our mobile phones and charge them up, and then the electricity went off. And it was off for another 24 hours until it came back on for, at that time, half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So the municipal grid doesn't provide electricity, and so people have to make do. And it's not the best solution because, as you said, it is polluting. But when the system ignores the regular people, the regular people have to turn to these alternative systems to get their electricity, because it is the modern world, and we depend on electricity for so much of our infrastructure.
Now, that begs a hypothetical for me, and because we talk about how people will react, we call them zombies in my camp, when quote-unquote civilization collapses, when there is no electricity. God knows what New York would have been like on the fourth day of the blackout in 2003. But I also wonder what would happen if there was a sudden massive shortage of diesel fuel, or it became prohibitively expensive. What would that do to the social fabric of the System D cities?
Well, it would be very difficult, look, but people would find their way around it. I mean, they are tremendously more resilient than I am here in Brooklyn. I would be paralyzed if the city, at least temporarily, if the city did not provide electricity, or if Con Edison here did not provide electricity. It would be much more difficult for me. Over there in Lagos, people would figure it out. Someone else, if diesel was too expensive, they'd switch to straight-out gasoline generators. Or someone would come with solar arrays. There would be a much quicker adaptation over there to what the price structure is, and also what the ecological factors are. So when oil runs, they're much more able to go with that flow than I am here.
So it's fair to say that System D is a state of mind?
Yep. That's exactly what I would look at. It's the state of mind that says, I'm going to be resilient and fight through whatever challenges are ahead.
And that's exactly why I wanted you on the show tonight, because we've been doing very well. Our listener numbers are growing, and we're reaching a very wide audience that's also somehow interwoven with Occupy and with all everything that's happening. And there is a change of consciousness taking place. And I used this analogy with you in a short phone call we had. It was the movie The Summer of 42. And this coming of age, and these young boys, 12, 13 years old, discover this 10 steps to how to have sex with a woman, but like steps 9 and 10 were missing. And the whole movie is about, so at the end of the movie, one of the boys becomes a man, and the other boys are waiting on the other side of a sand dune as he comes stumbling back, asking for water, clothes, and disarray. And he goes going back, and they ask him, what's after step 8? He goes, step 9, step 10, step 11. He's going over the hill. And it is a state of consciousness. And that's why I think your book is so important. Sorry for going long there, but this just really hit me. It's right in the gut.
It's absolutely true that, this is System D is essentially akin to step 8 and step 9 and step 10 and step 11.
Mm-hmm.
And we just haven't thought about it here in the West.
Well, and that's what we need to start doing, because obviously some serious economic dislocations are looming in front of us right now, with Europe going down and with bad economic news all over the planet.
I do want to say, Mike, I don't want to minimize how difficult that life can be.
Yeah.
I'm working in System D. You got to work real hard, folks are putting in their time and eking out a living in some cases. So it's not like a get-rich-quick scheme. It is the economy of resiliency, and that's what it takes. It's the same way that you would do a startup business, here in the West. When you start up, you got to put your time in, and you don't take your money out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how would you talk about quality of life that you observed there? Were people having good lives? Some?
Well, look, how do you determine quality of life?
Happy,
they always talk about, if you ask people in the favelas of Brazil, are you happy? They always say yes. Look, people make do, and they make their choices, and they live according to those choices. And the System D people are actually doing better than the people with college educations, for
mm-hmm.
instance, in Lagos, because there are no jobs for people with college educations, and they're too proud to go into selling stuff on the street. But in reality, the quality of life is difficult, the government is not supporting these businesses. In fact, it's been trying to shut down a bunch of the street markets, and people have to really watch out for the authorities. So this kind of concerted effort by the government to battle the System D economy and in some cases wipe it out has been really difficult for people, and it's not an easy life by any means.
Have you been to Japan at all?
I have never been to Japan.
Okay, yeah, I'm very curious, because Japan is sinking, of course, under Fukushima, the highest debt-to-GDP ratio in the world. TEPCO has been nationalized. They're about to fail economically, and their government just announced they were going to double the sales tax. And I said, what would that do to a System B economy if there was one in Japan? But we see that pattern everywhere, as we see austerity measures being imposed in Greece, with Germany issuing ultimatums, that you will let us control your budget or else, and of course we see it here and all over the world. That's only going to drive people into System D, right?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. And I think System D is growing in Greece as it is. Indeed, a Greek reporter sent me an article that was online in English, fortunately, because I don't read Greek. But it was about metal recyclers in downtown Athens.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the metal recyclers have determined that, there are these recycling industries that need all this metal and are willing to pay top dollar for it. And they're actually probably making 20 to 30 euros a day tax-free, which doesn't sound like a lot of money, but is more, given the austerity measures, than a lot of formerly employed people are making. So the system D people are doing better. And I would expect with the continued austerity that Germany and other European countries are forcing down Greece's throat, that system D will grow.
Okay.
People will turn to it in order to survive.
Yeah, and here I'm looking at Barack Obama boasting about U.S. exports increasing. And what are we exporting? Scrap metal and diesel fuel, because we have some of the few functioning refineries left. I mean, our system, the existing system, is scavenging itself. Okay, so what popped into mind there as I was going back through your book? The self-organizing and how system D economies and marketplaces, and I saw this in all the places you wrote about, tend to police themselves and quickly establish a pretty efficient social order.
Absolutely. I mean, most markets have a kind of market court which functions to adjudicate disputes between buyers and sellers. And they'll, you know, they'll handle that. It's mostly arbitration. It's not like a formal court. There isn't a, you know, guy wearing a wig and a person taking notes. But, you know, they negotiate deals between people who are aggrieved with each other. There's market security forces, so they don't get police protection in these markets mostly. The police are your enemy, not your friend. Occupy Wall Street has found that out too here in the United States.
Indeed.
You know, in the end, they police themselves. If there are criminals who are pickpocketing people in the market, that's not good for the market. So they try to police themselves, they create security task force, and they come together to create a kind of cooperative community.
I saw that exact same process at work in the exact same way in the Occupy movement. People thrown together who had never known each other, never worked with each other, suddenly and quickly and efficiently, and I would say with minimal expenditure of unnecessary energy, finding social ways to work. And I was amazed, quite frankly, at how facile everybody, it just seemed to happen organically.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing what people can do, given when they're all pulling in the same direction.
Wow.
So it really does happen.
How is the book doing? I'm assuming it's really doing well. I haven't checked.
Well, you know, I made up my mind when I started writing books that I wasn't going to obsessively follow and track them day to day on the sales data.
Yeah.
I'm sure that it's going to do a lot better now that I've been on your radio show, right?
Oh, I sure hope so, because
it's doing great. I mean, I'm getting a lot of good attention, and even the mainstream media. I mean, look, when the Wall Street Journal reviews it, you know, you can't get more sort of wackily mainstream than that. So, you know, I've gotten some good attention, and I'm happy about that.
I'm here in Sebastopol, California, and Transition US is headquartered here, and I think I want to buy a few copies of your book and just start handing them out at Transition US, because this is just, it's such an eye opener about things that are possible, and it's a good social model. And you know, I just did this thing tonight where I wrote something that Iran is behaving very professionally now, and the U.S. is just looking absolutely not credible across the planet.
Right.
And you know, my basic point was, hey, look, this is not about siding with America. It's like Americans don't openly side with liars and gangsters. And yet, that's what I have a feeling that System D, in the blink of an eye, could suddenly become, you know, 60%, 70% of the global economy, which really calls into question all the rules, the rulers, and everything else that's out there. We've been looking for a reset for a long time, and System D, maybe that's part of a reset. I don't know.
Well, I would argue that it is. I mean, look, you know, it's not my insight. I mean, Karl Polanyi wrote this back in the 1940s. But the idea is that we've subsumed society under the economy. And we have to turn that around. The economy has to be responsible to all of our social desires and beliefs and connections. And that's part of what the potential of System D is, that System D allows community to run the show. And the economic relationships, they handle themselves under the community values.
That sounds like music to me. Say that again. System D allows what to run the show? Community to run the show?
Yeah. System D allows community to run the show. The merchants can come together as a community, as a market, in a location, and they run that market. And they run it together with the purchasers in a sort of giant kind of cooperative, even though it's not registered and official in that sense. And that's what we've gotten away from. We allow the market, the free market, supposedly, all the big businesses to run the show, and our social relationships are secondary. And that's the big problem. System D has the potential, yes, of reversing that.
There is so much happening in this world so fast, and System D is a huge part of it. And I, you know, I'm just so grateful to you for writing this book and bringing it up. Are you getting a lot of requests to? Where's most of the interest coming from? From what demographics?
Well, you know,
who's responding to the book?
You know, the interesting thing is that the free marketeers on the right and the libertarians, they sort of want to adopt me. Which kind of makes me smile. Then they get angry at me because I'm against things like child labor. You know, it's just very funny to me that people read this book as if it's a peon and a tribute to just brute capitalism. I see it much differently.
Yeah.
I see it more as an anarchistic view of what people can do when they're liberated to do it themselves. That's not pure profit and loss.
No.
People want community. They want to create community. We're not just profit-seeking Roombas who roam around the world sucking up profit. What we are is people who establish relationships and community.
I think, you know, as I was listening to this, it came up more than once reading the book, and it really is an everybody get the book and read it, dag nabbit, Eric Fromm's Flight from Freedom, is that there are people who are so conditioned to flee back into whatever the matrix, and what I saw with System D was there is a enormous amount of freedom here, and if nothing else, leaving aside political, you know, dogma, freedom works.
Yeah. Freedom does work. And the thing that government has to recognize, and there may be a role for government to play in all of this, but what government has to recognize is that the way it acts is part of a social contract.
Mm-hmm.
Government has to provide for people. That's the purpose of government. If government doesn't do things for the population, then that government is illegitimate, in my view. And so that's the other side of System D, that what people can do for themselves, let's have them do for themselves. And government should be there to be the arbiter and the leveler. And that's fine, but government has to show it can do that.
Yeah, yeah. And to avoid the knee-jerk reaction, you know, that some people will have as a result of conditioning, I just say that look at System D and understand that whatever happens, there is hope for you because other people are showing you how to do that now. I tell this story about a bear attack in a camp, and you know, and a bunch of campers, and you don't have to be faster than the bear. You just got to be faster than the slowest camper. System D folks are not slow campers.
No, they're not slow campers.
But
the other thing is that System D folks are going to figure out, they're going to work together to figure out how can we all be safe.
Right. Okay, think back across your experience to some large event that happened in any one of the venues you were at. You know, that was a sudden destabilizing event, you know, a wound, you know, a barricade, a sudden toll, a raid, something like that. How quickly would a system, did the System D respond to this, start to adapt organically to a major problem? What was the problem, you know?
Well, I mean, look, the immediate problem problem for many of the markets is when the police come marauding through. And so at Rua 25 de Março, which is this massive street market in downtown São Paulo, Brazil, periodically the police decide that they're just going to mass in the area and not allow people to set up. And, you know, people deal with that by milling around and trying to outwit the cops. I mean, it isn't very scientific, and it isn't a kind of adaptive strategy. They just do what comes natural. But when the cops are there for too many days in a row, then they just move to a new turf, and everyone knows that they go to this other market area in a community called Brás, and they set up shop there. So it becomes a cat and mouse game around the city. That's a very small example of it. Another example is, in Nigeria, they periodically ban the import of Chinese shoes because they're trying to support indigenous manufacturing of shoes. And System D works in both cases. System D is both the importing of the Chinese shoes, but it's also the production of the Nigerian shoes. And so they have their foot in both both pieces of the pie, and they'll work whichever one is the most appropriate.
It sounds also like a little bit like water following a path of least resistance, not looking for confrontation. And also from what I gather, pretty safe. I mean, because the markets have to be safe, otherwise they wouldn't have any customers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the surprising thing is that people, even in Nigeria, people badmouth some of the big markets as being hugely unsafe, and they're certainly noisy and cacophonous and can be difficult to negotiate. But I never personally found them unsafe. And the people that I knew that worked there didn't personally find them unsafe. So that becomes just a huge canard, that people feel that these areas are unsafe because the government and because big businesses are always repeating, oh, they're criminals, they're criminals, they're criminals. And so they must be criminals.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that needs to be shed. And you made the point very clearly in the book that people think of black market and they assume people dealing guns, drugs, you know, sex slaves, whatever. That's not the case. This is just people who are not on the books, you know, selling licensed goods, paying taxes, holding, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right. But the $10 trillion that I quoted at the top of the show is all legitimate stuff. We're not talking about gun running. We're not talking about organ harvesting. We're not talking about human trafficking. There's no pirated nukes involved in this economy. It's all legal product just sold in this quasi-legal way.
But the banks still get their cuts, don't they?
Well, of course. I mean, you got to park your money somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, the irony of the whole System D street market economy is that most of these merchants, including the tiniest ones of them, have bank accounts. They just can't get loans because the banks think they're illegitimate and they have no collateral.
Right.
But the banks will take their money and earn interest on it, of course.
Was there a competitive off-books loan trade in these markets?
Yeah, I mean, there's always that. That can be a bit usurious.
Yeah.
But given that interest rates are high in most of the banks in the developing world, it can sometimes be better to go to the informal money lender than the formal money lender. But look, it's mostly a cash economy. So you're mostly not getting bank loans to turn your business deals. You're using the cash that you just made last week.
Now, when we say cash, most people think of paper bills. Are we talking all U.S. dollars here? How dominant is the dollar?
Well, the dollar is the lingua franca of the world economy, basically. It's the universal translator. And that's what I meant earlier when I said that currency exchange rates are absolutely crucial in this.
Mm-hmm.
So dollar dove after 2008. It made it very difficult for Nigerian traders because the Nigerian naira also fell against the dollar, so their fall was twice as hard. And they had to convert their naira into dollars and then their dollars into yuan to do business with the Chinese.
Is the naira pegged?
Yeah, totally screwed.
Is the naira pegged to the dollar?
No.
Okay.
So the idea is that the naira fell even harder than the dollar fell. The value of the naira dropped substantially against the dollar, and the value of the dollar drops substantially against the Chinese currency.
It seems that there are
a lot of money on their currency exchanges.
It seems that there are a tremendous amount of vulnerabilities for a system that overall seems so robust.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what you're suggesting there. System D, or is the robust system
The people having to worry about fluctuations in currency from one day to the next, or whether there's electricity from one day to the next, or all these little things that seem stand alone, somewhat fragile, but they weave a pretty strong web.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, folks are at the mercy of a lot of different big things. Absolutely.
Well, you are an amazing hope-giving author, Robert Neuwirth. I want to thank you for joining us tonight. I'm going to wrap up in a couple of minutes here. The book is Stealth of Nations by Robert Neuwirth, Neuwirth. We will be talking about it on CollapseNet. What are you up to now?
Well,
you got to write another book?
I'm going to write another book, but I have no idea what it'll be about.
I sure would like to be in a room and sit you down with Charles Eisenstein of Sacred Economics, because I just still see that as like two ends of a bridge, and somewhere in there is the way that all of us who plan on surviving post-collapse in a new human paradigm can get from here to there. And I think you've laid a very, very important part of that bridge for us. I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you. It's been
a
pleasure.
Robert. Okay, now I've got a few minutes left, and I'm going to use those, because I'm watching closely what's going on out in the world. I just went through before the show started tonight the news links, which is the stuff that we put up on the World News Desk at CollapseNet, and there are some things that I'm pretty alarmed about, and I guess I want to plant in all your guys' heads for the coming week. Violence is really increasing around the world. There's a lot of angry people out there. And again, this is midwinter. Now, we had, you know, thought about coming back in the spring, but I'm watching this very closely because I'm kind of concerned, because we are very, very close with Greece right now. It has come down to a hard default. Basically, Germany delivered Greece essentially an ultimatum, saying, you know, not just Greece, Germany went to the EU and said, you will give us policing powers. And it said that debt service had to be an absolute priority. Debt service. Germany was asking for the police power to enforce debt service. You will pay your interest on your loan first. You can eat sometime after that if it's convenient. And, of course, Greece is not going for that. There was a story that said Greece politely refused, but I don't think Greece politely refused at all. But the other dynamic that's taking place in Europe right now is fault lines that are so European. David Cameron, Britain never fully opted in to the EU. And David Cameron walked, and so there's a fault line there. But you can rest assured, and we see these tensions rising, that Britain will not allow Germany to become the financial policeman of Europe, because of the Rothschilds family. The Rothschilds that said, you know, I don't care who makes the laws or who's the president, give me control of a nation's money and you have everything. So Britain won't allow that. But it's amazing how these historical faults are surfacing. And as I look at the situation in the Middle East, again, Iran is behaving on the world stage. The whole world is watching. You know, we said that at Occupy, you know, to the cops that they were pepper spraying and doing that. Well, somebody needs to say also to the United States and Barack Obama, the whole world is watching. And in this public relations contest, the United States looks absolutely horrible. Iran is a world power now. And I just we put a tape up on the CollapseNet before the show that I'm going to leave there through tonight and tomorrow. It's a Russia Today tape, an interview with an Iranian professor. And you know what? This guy is articulate. He tells the truth. I have no sense of bullshit about him. There's no feeling that the And what I'm amazed now, we were talking during the show tonight, Robert Neuwirth is, he triggers just a lot of thought in me. But we were talking in the show tonight, credibility means a lot, and energy efficiency means a lot. And Iran's doing the deed right now. Iran is a world power. And the social contract, as we were talking during the show, has been broken. The reason why I can even get away with saying this, and I'm not getting hate mail for this, and all the people who are speaking out, Ron Paul is not. Ron Paul is ringing bells all over the place. Because it's truth-telling that's resonating now because the social contract has been broken. It's clear, you know, if I were to say the biggest difference between now when people listen to the message I've been carrying for so long and 20 years ago now is they're listening because their world isn't working, because the fabric of the matrix is ripping up right in front of them and they see no reason to defend people who are so obviously lying. This is going to be an amazing year. In May, Occupy will be doing a big thing in Chicago, and I'm kind of thinking about wanting to go there. I kind of teased about it and said, if somebody invites me, I'll go. I think Shamar Thomas would like to go. But I think Occupy needs to come back this next year very, very strong, very, very focused, very, very disciplined and organized in nonviolence. Because absent that, Occupy stepped up last year at a point when the cities in the U.S. were about to go up, like England had gone up earlier in the year. And Occupy took all that energy and channeled it into nonviolence, and we scored some major points. Well, now, next year, it's not just a matter of doing that as a way of leading. It's a matter of if we don't do that, then all hell's going to break loose. Going to be a hell of a year, and I'm pretty optimistic now. There's been just some really encouraging things going on, like Robert Neuwirth we had on the show tonight, and all the stuff we're bringing you at CollapseNet. Our side is not defeatist. We are winning. We are out. Walk tall, walk proud. We are part of a new human paradigm, and we meet here every Sunday on the Lifeboat Hour. I'm going to be 61 years old next Friday. We're going to have a hell of a party here. I'm doing two legs of lamb and having all my friends in this wonderful place that I've come to live. 61 years. When I started this, I was a 27-year-old cop. I'm so grateful to all of you who have walked a lot of this distance with me. So anyway, until next week, see you guys. It's Mike Rupert. Come back to the Lifeboat Hour next Sunday. Bye.